Title of my remarks today is A Spiritual Look at Voting in America. This is a difficult material to put together, and yes, it has been garnered over many years. I'm going to ask my brother Jose, is it possible, friend, to activate a timer utility there? My biggest fear is that I'll be going over time, and I don't want to burden you guys. Now, there's going to be a lot of reading here, historical readings, readings from the scriptures. In this material, the most important thing is our identity in Messiah. Nothing else matters. In Colossians 3:3, it says, "For you are dead and your life is hid with the Messiah and Elohim." Of course, I'm an American. I don't have a party affiliation. Maybe I should go do that. But primarily, I'm a member of Yahweh's kingdom through Yahshua. That overrules everything. Now, we have laws in the Bible about how to relate to the governments that oversee us. Clear laws. The only time we should disobey the laws of the kingdom is if they're commanding us to disobey Yahweh. There'll be no doctrine here about voting, but I'll be giving you toward the end some tips about how to look at it in a very spiritual sense. I forgot to mention it, but there'll certainly be no political messages here. Okay. By the way, when I put these notes together, I experimented with some of the fade-outs on the slides. I'm convinced that some of these are absolutely garish. I apologize in advance. You're going to see some that make you dizzy. Question, could we justify voting in any of these scenarios? Here's a sampling of scenarios in which we could justify voting. I was going to ask you for some water, Javon. Thank you. Anyway, there's going to be two chunks of statements here. This first clustering addressed the question of, can we vote? And these are just different ways of looking at it through biblical eyes to justify voting. Some people claim we are members of an Israelite nation and we have every reason to participate in its government. Yeah, by the way, there's no criticism here of anybody. If you believe in voting, you will not be offended today. If you don't believe in voting, you will not be offended today. These are just different biblical ways of approaching this. In other words, do we have a biblical precedence for what we have today? If I believe that I was Israelite and this whole country is Israelite, as some people do believe, then of course I should participate. Another approach is to say we are members of a Christian nation, and because we are baptized into the Messiah, we have every reason to participate. In other words, it's just a bunch of Christians in this country, and that's the framework, that's the foundation, and on that basis, we should feel free to participate too. I know that we're in a kind of a strict branch of the Messianic faith. Given enough time, I can prove to you this is the most original and most correct, but anyway, that's a reasonable basis to step up if you really believe it's a Christian nation. This one takes a little more explaining. Some people look at us as being in a Babylonian-type captivity. We are captive in Babylon, and we must seek the welfare of the nation that is hosting us. In Jeremiah 29, verse 4-7, Yahweh coaches the Israelites. I better drink this water now. Please excuse me. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the Elohim of Israel, unto all that are carried away captives, whom I have caused to be carried away from Jerusalem unto Babylon, build ye houses and dwell in them, and plant gardens, and eat the fruit of them. Take ye wives, and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons, and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, that you may be increased there, and not diminished. And seek the peace of the city, whither I have caused you to be carried away captives, and pray unto Yahweh for it, for in the peace thereof shall you have peace. That clause, seek the peace of the city, that could be interpreted as a go-ahead to participate also in the government if they let you. Another angle is to say we are the salt of the earth and we must lend positive influence where we can. Matthew 5, verse 13-16, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt shall lose its flavor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is therefore thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden underfoot of men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and honor your Father which is in heaven. Now, there's a limitation to this. Suppose, I'm just going to make something up. Suppose my company, my business makes ice cubes. And I've persuaded the government to subsidize ice cubes. I've lobbied them. I've taken senators and congressmen to big buffet lunches and schmoozed with the politicians and got them to pass a law that the government will subsidize my ice cube business. Well, that's an example of voting in my own interests. Hey, tell everybody who works for me, vote for that guy because he's going to subsidize our business. Then we can all get houses and raises and things like that. On the other hand, suppose you're voting for the general welfare. Suppose there's an emerging threat to our nation. It's becoming obvious over time that one candidate sees it as not a threat, but you do see it as a threat. It's very reasonable for you to cast a vote for, in this context, it's reasonable to cast a vote for the candidate you think would protect people on a broad basis. Here's some more. Another way of approaching the decision to vote. We are subjects of an occupational force, and we can only influence local matters, like the Jews of Yahshua's time. And at times, we will suffer abuse under that kind of a system. The Jews were under an occupational force of Rome. The scepter had been stripped from their crown. They had some kind of a king right up until the time of Herod. But Herod was stripped of the ability to utter capital punishment decrees. And the Jews interpreted that as a sign that something really bad happened. And it's on record that there are Jews who bowed their head in grief and prayed, "Oh, woe is us. The scepter has departed from Judah and the Messiah had not come." And this was shortly before Yahshua arrived. You would think that they would put their periscopes up and say, "He's on the way," because the scepter has departed from Judah. They had an occupational force, and all they could do was make local, regional-like decisions. And then finally, here's a simple strategic decision where someone decides to vote. Suppose you just have two candidates on the ticket. I don't care what election it is. And you think in your mind, well, one of two doors is going to open, not both. Not none of them. Out of those two doors, one of them's going to open up. And I can influence which one it is. I mean, you really have no choice. One of those doors is going to open. All you can do is influence one or the other. These are various ways of approaching the decision to vote. And some of them look more spiritual than others. I admit that. But let's see if we can find some justification to not vote. And I have a handful of scenarios for that. One is to conclude that voting is the devil's casino. I cannot win if I play there. In Luke 4, verse 5 to 7, it records Yahshua's temptation. It says, "And the devil, taking him up high into an high mountain, showed unto him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said unto him, All this power will I give unto thee, and the preeminence of them, for that is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will, I give it. If thou therefore will worship me, all shall be thine." You know, the Bible's actually lacking in scriptures to indicate Satan runs the governments. The preponderance of the scriptures say that Yahweh decides. So where does this guy get off saying this? Yahshua doesn't rebuke him, by the way. Instead, Yahshua quotes the command that tells us only to worship Yahweh. Now me, I would have been like our mother Eve. I would have entered into an argument with him. I would have entered into a dialogue with the devil and said, "Well, wait a minute, what makes you think you got all these nations? We have so many scriptures that say Yahweh's in charge." I think that If Yahshua had bowed to the evil one, it would have been an acceptance of the authority he wrongly claimed. It was a bluff. And those of us who've studied these spiritual realities will tell you the vast majority, I would say 100% of what Satan throws at us is a bluff. It's a big, stinking bluff. It's really a question of how much evil you're letting into your life. That's really, you know, you think back at the compromises, the poor decisions you've made, you know. And then there's the times where Yahweh ordains a trial, and it's just a trial. That's all it is. And I wish I had time to go off on a bunny trail and tell you what a big bluff the evil one is. There's another verse in 2 Corinthians verse 4, chapter 4, verse 3 to 4. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 3 to 4. But if our good news be hid, it is hid to them that are lost, in whom the Elohim of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the magnificent good news of the Messiah, who is the image of Elohim, should shine upon them. Now, it doesn't mention the devil here or Satan, but you can be confident that that's the right interpretation. The Elohim of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not. I can't emphasize enough before I go to the next slide that this business of the Elohim of the world, Satan ruling nations, it's because they let that evil in. The preponderance of Scripture, there's one of those wacky transitions. That looks like the concentration game. Do you remember concentration? Okay. Another way of rejecting the choice to vote is to say the lesser of two evils is still evil, and not voting is a protest against that evil. Romans 14, verse 22 says, "Hast thou faith? Have it to thyself before Elohim. Blessed is he that condemns not himself and that thing which he approves." And it might be interpreted that if you vote for the lesser of two evils, you're still approving evil. On that basis, some people in good conscience back off and say, I can't do it. I just can't do it. Another way to approach it is to simply say, Yahweh will decide, and the Bible says so. I do not need to participate. This is in Yahweh's hands. I still remember that night that Ryan Mansager read the book of Daniel for my Bible project. And in the recording, this verse jumped out at me. Daniel chapter 4, verse 17. Last half of the verse. The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men. I underline the basest of men. Are you disappointed with the kind of leaders we have in this world? Yahweh's admitting here. He sets up the basest of men. One might argue that this is a dirty job. This gets into some of that hard reading I'm talking about now. Another way to approach this is to say, you know, no matter who I vote for, he's going to let me down. It's best not to get involved. 1 Samuel 8, there's a portion here that reads as follows. And Samuel told all the words of Yahweh unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. Boy, some of this sounds like today's headlines, doesn't it? And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries and to be cooks and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep. You shall be his servants, and you shall cry out in that day because of your king, which you shall have chosen you, and Yahweh will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, but we will have a king over us. And this reads just like the headlines. I mean, the the reality of political promises unfulfilled is always staring us in the face. I'm going to take one of those themes that I cited, themes in which context in which you'd say, I should vote, and context in which you'd say, I can't vote. I have absolutely no criticism of everybody, anybody, but I would like all of you to go down a path with me, and let's explore the question of whether this can be called a Christian nation. Was the original revolution, the founding of this nation, an appeal from one bunch of Christians to a harsh Christian king? Now, we don't normally call ourselves Christian here, but I'm going to use that word for historical convenience. Now, here's the background. Yeah, those of you who are history buffs and bookworms, you might proofread me on this. I don't know, but you start out with a bunch of colonists here. Most of the colonies are British. And in the French Indian War, it pitted England and her American colonies against the French and Indian forces in the American continent. Internationally, it was known as the Seven Years' War, but the American theaters called the French Indian War. I'm going to read to you a summary from the webpage here for those who are listening in the audio outreach. If you look for a magazine called American Heritage, go to the webpage. Look for the year 2005 archives, and this is the issue, November-December issue. It has an article called The Real First World War, The Making of America. This is a summary of conditions in the colonies before we zoom in on the colonists and their revolt. For Britain and its American colonies, the war had complex, equivocal legacies. Its resultant policies created immense problems of public finance and territorial control. The virtual doubling of the national debt produced demands for retrenchment, even as administrators tried to impose economy, coherence, and efficiency on a haphazard imperial administration. Their goal was both to control the 300,000 or so Canadians and Indians whom the war had ushered into the empire, and to make the North American colonies cooperate with one another, take direction from London, and I emphasize, pay the cost of imperial defense. You see, the colonies partnered with Britain to win the French Indian War, but that cost a lot of money. In London, the king wanted to make the Americans pay for it. Britain's American colonists had come to believe they were members of a transatlantic community bound together by common allegiance, interests, laws, and rights. Imperial administrators found this absurd. Even before they had been proposing reforms that would have made it clear the colonists were anything but legal and constitutional equals of subjects who lived in England. The outbreak of the fighting had suspended those reforms. And then the policies of Britain's war leader, William Pitt, had encouraged the colonists to see the empire as a voluntary union of British patriots on both sides of the ocean. So in the mind of the colonists, they're saying, hey, we helped you win this war. We're with you. We love the king. We love being British. We're with you. We're equals to all those British folks over there in the on the British Islands. So when the empire's administrators moved to reassert the pre-war hierarchy, the colonists reacted first with shock and then with fury. What happened, they wanted to know, to the patriotic partnership that had won the war. Why are we suddenly being treated as if we were the conquered instead of the conquerors? So say, what happened? We used to be friends. And to get these dollars out of the colonies, they raised taxes that the people in Britain didn't have to carry. In the eyes of the crown, he's thinking, well, you folks in America, you benefited from this French-Indian War. Now you got to pay for it. And the British are thinking, well, how come we're not being treated equal to the British over there on the islands? And the tax collection got kind of rough. It got really rough. And the rebellion to the tax got rough. There's a famous document called the Olive Branch Petition. I'd like you to catch the theme of this. This is what I'm going to be reading to you. It's more important to catch the tone and the mood. The colonists appeal to the king for relief of oppressions. I'm going to ask if you think this is messianic in tone. Again, the question is, was this a bunch of Christians appealing to a Christian king? Excuse me. I'm going to be reading three portions from a document called the Olive Branch Petition. I'll be reading the offenses later. I'd like you to assume that the colonists were being harshly treated. I want you to hear the lofty language that was carefully crafted. "Thus called upon to address your majesty on affairs of such moment to America and probably to all your dominions, we are earnestly desirous of performing this office with the utmost deference to your majesty. And we therefore pray that your majesty's royal magnanimity and benevolence may make the most favorable constructions of our expressions on so uncommon an occasion. Could we represent in their full force the sentiments that agitate the minds of us, your dutiful subjects, we are persuaded your majesty would ascribe any seeming deviation from reverence in our language and even our conduct, not to any reprehensible intention, but to the impossibility of reconciling the usual appearances of respect with a just attention to our own preservation against those artful and cruel enemies who abuse your royal confidence and authority for the purpose of effecting our destruction." Okay, they're giving the king the benefit of the doubt. They're saying, there's people here who are claiming your authority, and they're beating us up. We don't think you want that. And if we seem agitated, it's not out of your reverence. "We beg leave further to assure your majesty that notwithstanding the sufferings of your loyal colonists during the course of this present controversy, our breasts render too tender a regard for the kingdom from which we derive our origin to request such a reconciliation as might in any manner be inconsistent with her dignity or welfare. These related as we are to her honor and duty, as well as inclination, induce us to support and advance, and the apprehensions that now oppress our hearts with unspeakable grief being once removed, your majesty will find your faithful subjects on this continent ready and willing at all times, as they have ever been, with their lives and fortunes, to assert and maintain the rights and interests of your majesty and of our mother country." Well, let me try to interpret this. Suppose you've been friends with somebody a long time and then they betray you. I mean, cliches come to mind. "Hey, I thought we were friends. Hey, I thought we were married. Hey, I thought we had an agreement. I thought we had a deal. I thought we had a relationship." These colonists thought themselves as equals to the British subjects in the British Islands. And suddenly they're being hunted like animals, as you will see. They're saying, "We want to be buddies with you. We want to be friends with you." This was the last correspondence they sent before the declaration. Now from the conclusion, "For such arrangements as your majesty's wisdom can form for collecting the united sense of your American people, we are convinced your majesty would receive such satisfactory proofs of the disposition of the colonists towards their sovereign and parent state, that the wished for opportunity would soon be restored to them of evincing the sincerity of their professions by every testimony of devotion, becoming the most dutiful subjects and the most affectionate colonists. That your majesty may enjoy a long and prosperous reign, and that your descendants may govern your dominions with honor to themselves and happiness to their subjects, is our sincere prayer." That clause in the second to last paragraph at the end, "and the most affectionate colonists," they're just pouring out their love to the king in this document. A lot of people don't remember this from school. Maybe your school never even covered it. The Olive Branch Petition. Well, there's two things that worked against this petition. One of the signers was a guy named John Adams. You've heard of John Adams. In a private letter to an associate, he expressed the belief that war was inevitable. That letter was captured, and it arrived at the king's throne room before this thing arrived. And so when this thing arrived, the king was already offended having seen John Adams say war is inevitable. The king never managed to read this beautiful document. He refused to read it. An outpouring of love and affection. By the way, I guess we would call that an ancient example of WikiLeaks, huh? To have a letter leaked out like that. The appeal sounds messianic in tone, but what was the follow-up? It sounds like a set of Christians appealing to our other set of Christians, saying, can we get back together again? Can we reconcile? The colonists wanted to be treated as full subjects of the crown. The king wanted them to maintain colonist status and pay extra taxes. The colonists wanted local administrators to act kindly and justly. The king felt justified in smacking down these tax rebels. By the way, I can see both sides of this. The messianic ethic would require them to pay those taxes to begin with. Render unto Caesar. The messianic ethic would require them to defer to the government authorities. 1 Peter 2, 13-16. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the master's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of Elohim, that with well-doing you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of Yahweh. Still, I'm leaving unanswered the question, was this a bunch of practicing Christians appealing to a Christian king? Please treat us nice. We're members of the same religion. We're your brothers. This is going to take a while. A lot of people have never read this. I read this a few years ago and my jaw dropped. These grievances against the king were embodied in the Declaration. And some of this sounds like today's headlines. Try to imagine now, put yourself in their shoes, a bunch of Christians appealing to a Christian king. They have a clause before they list the grievances. They say, let the facts be submitted to a candid world. They're saying, let the whole world see what we're going through. At the very end, they close their appeal with a faith in divine providence. I may skip over some of these in the interest of time, but here goes. He has refused to assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent would be obtained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, and thus those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. You have to understand, the things they're calling for were the standard life for them as subjects of the crown. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. Have you ever had to deal with government red tape? He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers incapable of annihilation have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining, in the meantime, exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners. Refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations here and raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. I may come back to that. Then there's specific things they indict him for: cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. Yeah, I'll be coming to that in a bit, I hope. He has combined with others to subject us to the jurisdiction foreign to our constitution and not acknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. for quartering large bodies of armed troops amongst us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren or fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. You heard some of it. Our repeated petitions have been unanswered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Okay, that ends the list of grievances. Discussion, was the rebellion a biblically ordained action? Is that something you could look in the Bible and say, yep, we can do that? They refused to pay taxes. That was bad. There was acts of terrorism. That was bad. And there's no mention of Yahshua and his sovereignty in these documents. That was bad too. If I wanted to assume this was a Christian action, there are things that are lacking in the profile. I want to speak to acts of terrorism, because there are two sides to this. The Boston Tea Party was an act of terrorism. Anybody who thinks otherwise is not thinking. No believer in Yahshua has a right to dress himself up as an Indian, then trespass on somebody's boat and dump the cargo in the ocean. And that's what the Tea Party was. There's no way a practicing Christian could agree to that. Let's talk about another one, though, because there's clauses there in those list of grievances that sound like police brutality. You can't get around it. They didn't have police back then. They had standing armies and soldiers and that. If you remember the Boston Massacre, I wonder why Boston keeps coming up. You wonder about the Boston Massacre. That's where a bunch of British soldiers fired upon the citizens. But if you get the whole story, the citizens were throwing rocks, bottles, and snowballs at the soldiers. Frankly, I think it's kind of stupid to throw rocks, bottles, and snowballs at somebody with a gun. But they were taunting them. This almost looks like something out of today's headlines. People taunting the cops shooting back. And all you need is a few bad apples to commit sin against the police. All you need is a few bad apples among the police, and now you've got a media event. They played up that Boston Massacre as a media event. These facts would tend to detract from the conclusion that this was a Christian nation appealing to a king to treat them nice. So was their actions biblically ordained? History shows Yahweh blessed the rebellion with success. Again, the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth to whomsoever he will and setteth up over it the basest of men. I'm trying to analyze this from both sides, and I think there's some facts here that will compel us to look a little closer, some surprising things. The only way this rebellion makes any sense before heaven is that it is interpreted as a bunch of Christians begging a Christian king to relieve them of their oppressions, a transaction operating within the household of faith. There's nothing in the scriptures that give us, as believers, permission to cause a rebellion. There's just nothing there. It is a controversy that obviously got out of hand. Along the way, a number of doofuses got in the mix and gave it a very rough edge. Out of 56 signers of the Declaration, all of them were Christian, except Thomas Jefferson, who was a deist. So it looks like they were Christian. If we can subtract out certain elements in the story, it does start to look like it was Christians, and that this really was a Christian nation at its beginning. Think about it. Even the most devout Christian, I think, if his home was attacked, he would defend his family. I'm a victim of my culture, but defending your family makes a whole lot of sense. And if some of those really severe claims at the end of the list, given those as a reality, you could see where people say, you know, I got a family to protect here. They're burning houses, burning towns, sinking our ships. The Magna Carta, for me, nails it. The Magna Carta. Now, I know I bet everybody here has heard the words Magna Carta, and maybe you dozed off to sleep in school like I did when you were taught this in formal education. So I want to talk about it very briefly and underscore the spiritual significance of this. The Magna Carta, the Magna means great, Carta means the charter, of 1215. It's an agreement between the kings and the people to respect many rights of free men. It mentions God 5 times, and it mentions the church 7 times. That makes it a Christian document. You can't get around it. Well, if you were to read a nice translation of it, because it's Old English, but if you read a nice translation, many of the terms and conditions seem either obvious to us or else they're obsolete. But there's something very critical in the Magna Carta. It established a Christian-based relationship between the people and the crown. You can't get around that. This was the basis of authority for the colonists to revolt and still identify as Christian. They're operating in a context that said, we're a Christian people, we're part of a Christian nation, and we have rights. Those rights were documented in the Magna Carta of 1215. They were further amended over the years, and those amendments are documented. I don't know if they realized this, what they had done spiritually. Let's put this discussion on pause. I'm going to talk about tithing. A lot of debate about tithing, a lot of needless debate about tithing. I claim the strongest evidence for the tithing law for us today is when Jacob made that vow to Yahweh. And some of you remember, he said, Yahweh, if you get me out of this trouble and you take care of me, I'll give you a tithe. That vow is on the head of everybody who is an offspring of Jacob. And it's us too, because we're grafted in through Yahshua. That to me is the strongest Torah-based evidence of the need for tithing. And where did he get the tithe from? Well, it looks like he got it from Grandpa Abraham. Now think about that. The commitment of one propagates to all his offspring. And the Magna Carta was like that, because it was incumbent upon the king and everybody after him, and the subjects too. Around 2009, some gal emerged. It was a pre-adolescent girl emerged on the internet, and she made a jumbo chart. Her webpage is called WeAreAllRelated.com. It's one word, WeAreAllRelated.com. This girl, I think she worked on it with her dad, a jumbo chart showing every president of the United States traces their ancestry to King John, who signed the Magna Carta. The only exception was Martin Van Buren. Every president. This gal tried to get an audience with President Obama, kept writing to her. I don't know if he ever let her there, but she wanted to present to him a framed copy of this chart. I bought it back in 2009. As soon as I saw it, I realized the spiritual implications. The king who signed the Magna Carta signed that for everybody who came after him. You may think this is a gag. I met a guy in Phoenix many years ago, and he was just obsessed with some research he was doing. He was ransacking libraries with genealogical information. He insisted, he explained to me, every president of the United States is related, and they in turn are all related to royalty. Some of these relationships to royalty are well documented. You could find them in common ordinary sources. But this gal, and that fellow I met in Phoenix, they believe they could prove that they were all related through strong documentary evidence to King John, the guy who signed the Magna Carta. Think about the spiritual implications. I can't go run into a courthouse with this. But from a spiritual perspective, that king, all the kings after him, and these presidents are all bound by that thing and the spirit of the thing. These are believers in Yahshua trying to make order out of a nation that has common beliefs. If you go look in that webpage, you can order that chart. It looks like she's still active. Now they are selling individual genealogies of individual presidents. So you can like order the genealogy for President Barack Obama. President Barack Obama traces back to King John, who signed the Magna Carta, along with all those other guys. That, for me, is just breathtaking. The spiritual implications of that cannot be overstated. This is not a conspiracy. This is not some wacko thing with UFOs. This is all verifiable. And I feel blessed because I have a second witness from a researcher in Phoenix. All presidents except one has lineage to the King John who signed the Magna Carta. This deems all governments derived from the crown as bound by the same biblical ethical framework. This explains the fervent dedication to human rights found in the Declaration and the Constitution. This is an argument from spiritual authority of vows and covenants. This puts things in a whole new light. If I deem the founders of this country as mostly Christian, I have to admit they were still flawed men. I still have to deal with that, don't I? Yahweh prospered their efforts and gave us a system where we are invited and often urged to participate in this system, which at its origin was informed by the Judeo-Christian ethic. Why would Yahweh bless this endeavor? Why would he bless this revolution? He obviously did. Let me hit the break again. I read about a contingent of Indians who came to Washington, D.C. I don't know if the capital was at Washington, but they came to the nation's capital. Maybe it was Philadelphia at the time, and they wanted to meet George Washington. They said, "We got to meet this guy. We fired all kinds of bullets at him, and he never fell. We shot his horse out from under him several times." Well, they wanted to meet this miracle man who they felt was protected by the Great Spirit through all these wars. Here's some of the reasons why I think this is opinion, but my objective here is to stimulate thought. Why would Yahweh prosper this rebellion? Because it really was a bunch of Christians appealing to a Christian king to treat them better. Religious liberty was preserved. It was enshrined in the Constitution. It was destined to be, anyway. But there's something here I really want to emphasize. National prayer, humility, and fasting. And this is a part of it that's really missing. This is not something like I'm trying to get dramatic with you. When you hear patriotic happy talk out there, this is the missing ingredient. The violent protests we see on our streets today have no regard for divine law, none. But these guys who founded this country, they were typically praying their heads off, scared to death. They wanted things to work out. They weren't anxious. There were rabble-rousers, like in Boston. Seems everything crazy comes out of Boston, huh? But you had rabble-rousers of Boston, but for the most part, they were reverently going about their task. The founders did a poor job of documenting a renunciation of the terrorist acts that came along with the original revolution. Modern rioters draw strength from that seeming approval of violence from the past. These guys were pushed into this. They didn't want it. They tried to get out of it. They were trying to protect their families. Let's talk about National Days of Prayer. I'll be reading three sections taken from Wikipedia. I don't like grabbing from Wikipedia. I tell my students the following. I say, you can make a point with Wikipedia, but you can't prove a point. But this rhymes, what I'm about to read you rhymes with other research I've done, showing that when they called for prayer, National Days of Prayer, they really meant business. It was like the King of Nineveh. Friction in 1768 to 76 between the American colonists and England spurred some American cities and colonies to proclaim days of prayer. For instance, Boston declared a day of fasting and prayer in September 1768 as a protest against a British plan to station troops in the city. The colony of Virginia's House of Burgesses established a day of fasting and prayer to take place on Wednesday, June 1st, 1774, to protest the Boston Port Act, such that the people of Virginia would assemble for prayer led by clergymen. Thomas Jefferson wrote that the effect of the day through the whole colony was like a shock of electricity, moving the Virginians to choose delegates to establish self-rule. The provinces of South Carolina, Maryland, and Georgia all observed official days of fasting and prayer during 1774 to 1775. We have a couple more of these to go. Now, I've heard of national days of prayer, but I never heard of national days of fasting in my lifetime. They seem to like Thanksgiving Day. Now they cheapen it and call it Turkey Day, or they tank up with all the abundance of the land and then watch sports. But the emphasis on fasting with the prayer emerges here. The observance of a day of fasting and prayer was brought to all of the colonists by the Continental Congress in 1775. Congress issued a proclamation recommending a day of public humiliation, fasting and prayer be observed by the English colonies on Thursday, July 20th, 1775, quote, and to bless our rightful sovereign, King George III, end of quote. The text written by John Witherspoon and John Hancock instructed the colonists to pray for a resumption of, quote, the just rights and privileges of the colonies in civil and religious matters. A proclamation to this end was sent to every town in the colonies. John Adams wrote that the popular response was gratifying, that the special day was more widely observed than the practice of going to church on Sunday. After this success, Congress determined to call for a day of fasting and prayer each spring and a day of thanksgiving and praise each fall. Well, that's a nice balance, fasting and prayer in the spring and in thanksgiving in the fall. In his role as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, General George Washington acknowledged the day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer, proclaimed by the Continental Congress to be held on Thursday, May 6, 1779. To enable his soldiers to observe the day, Washington ordered a one-day cessation of recreation and, quote, unquote, unnecessary labor. In March 1780, Congress announced the day of, quote, fasting, humiliation, and prayer to be held on Wednesday, April 26, 1780. Notice again the fasting in there. Well, that's part of the humility part. I mean, we get this from the book of Jonah. Now, the information I have outside of these references says that those calls to prayer, yeah, they typically mention prayer, fasting, humiliation, but also mentions beseeching the Almighty's forgiveness for our manifest sins, our obvious sins. No, friends, one thing we know about Yahweh is he's a nice guy, and he responds to humility. His heart will just gush open if you come to him with sincere humility. I have seen this over and over again. I see it in the Bible. There's an Italian regiment. There's a regiment called the Italian in the time of the apostles. A fellow named Cornelius was in charge of it. He was told that his prayers and his alms would come up as a memorial before heaven. When you read the story a little deeper in the book of Acts, you find that his prayers also included fasting. This element is missing in any modern political movements we see today, except for people in the background. You'll hear these anecdotal stories on some of the alternative news wires. You have thousands of people praying in Times Square this last election. You have people praying in Jerusalem this last election. You have congregations praying and fasting. When I see these idiots in the street, you know, busting windows and making noise, I know they just don't know better. I guarantee you in one generation they're going to be very sorrowful, just like my generation was, the Woodstock generation. So there's still some people crying out and praying about the welfare of the nation. We have now a system we inherited. The framers of the system took upon themselves the doubt, the guilt, and the burden of setting up this thing. But they were they Christian founders? Now, I've established to my satisfaction, and hopefully yours, that they are spiritually bound because of the Magna Carta. All these presidents being related to the king. There's a webpage called renewamerica.com, and there's an article here by Brian Fisher called "Were the Founders Christians?" Yep, no doubt about it. According to Dr. Emmy Bradford of the University of Dallas, of the 55 framers, 28 were Episcopalians, 8 were Presbyterians, 7 were Congregationalists, and there were 2 each of Lutherans, Dutch Reformed, Methodists, and Roman Catholics. That left, by Bradford's counting, 3 deists and 1 founder whose religious views cannot be determined definitively. So the overwhelming majority of men who wrote the Declaration were Christian, and the founders of the Constitution were Christian. In another time, another place, I didn't have time to access it, I can show you that approximately 80% of the guys who framed the Constitution, about 80% of them, did not own slaves. And that's important because from a distance, you have people who don't know better who will say, oh, it's just a bunch of slave owners. And there was actually quite a fight at the Continental Congress because Tom Jefferson wanted to include language to outlaw slavery, and the South said, no, we're not going to confederate as a nation if you do that. So they put it off for 2 generations, and we had the bloodiest war in our history. Let me make some intermediate conclusions. The USA started out as a flawed but nevertheless Christian nation, buoyed by prayer and reliance on Yahweh's providence. There's no question about that. They really looked to Yahweh. At least the leaders did. The people who left records behind did. The same system they set up invites us to participate in its government today. Each state was recognized independent as an individual country. You've got to look up the word state and find out it actually means a sovereign little country. Those 13 colonies became states, and they were even called so in some of that old documentation I read to you. They were considered little nations. And you see the root word feder, as in federal, federation, confederacy, confederation. That root feder means a bunch of people coming together to aggregate their energies for some cause. A lot of people don't know this because they're born in modern times. But this federal government, this big government that's sort of above us all, or it looks that way, it was actually manufactured at the pleasure of the states. It isn't like the federal government got together and then made a bunch of colonies into states. A bunch of states got together and said, let's make a federal government. And this is why, for example, in the presidential election, it's the only vote you take that affects everybody. And they don't let it operate as a popular vote. What happens is the popular vote works at your individual state, and your state decides what to do with their electoral votes. And the electoral votes you have is equal to the number of representatives in your state plus 2 for the senators. And so your state decides, well, where are we going to throw all our electoral votes? It's not a popular vote. It's states. I'll put it to you this way. The people don't elect the president. The states elect the president. And they carefully did that because they were scared to death of having a big tyrannical government. And because of what they went through with the king, the fact that the Magna Carta had to be forced down the throat of King John, they knew that there could be abuses. Well, that's a side topic, but I wanted to make that clear because there seems to be a lot of controversy over this. And even if I had a preferred candidate and he lost the popular, he lost the election, but he had the popular vote, it wouldn't bother me because I know it's not the people who elect the president, it's the states. Where are we today? This is what really gnaws away at us. The erosion of the Judeo-Christian ethic is happening big time. We're going to be winding down here, but I remember visiting the beloved Elder Warsop in England with the Congregation of Yahweh back there in Nottingham. And he had been in retirement for a few years. I went over there to interview him. I told him, I want to interview you. I want to talk to you. I said, you've been reading that Bible of yours for a long time now since you've been retired. Is there anything jumping out at you? Is there anything leaping off the pages? And he got a little dramatic. He took his glasses off like he was in a movie, and he put them down, and he folded his hands. Then he shook his head. I could still see that beautiful face of his framed by the beard and that head full of hair. He said, you can't get around it. our people are headed for divine judgment. It's just, there's no way you're going to escape it. Divine judgment is thundering our way. Everybody knows this. This can't go on. Even though our culture has eroded the Judeo-Christian underpinnings, the system of voluntary participation is still in place. The political processes are deeply tinged with corruption and foul play, admittedly. What is a saint supposed to do? The government originates on a biblical basis but has failed to stand firm. Now, I claim with a sufficiently righteous people, you would never have the problems we have today. All of our problems come from sin. Everything else we can handle. The stuff that's hard to handle is the stuff that comes from sin. So I'm going to give you some recent observations about voting. This is taking careful notes of what I see and talking to people. Many of the saints expressed a preferred outcome in the elections and expressed a desire to participate through voting. Despite each one of these saints that I've talked to having a preferred outcome, every one of them, 100% of the time, they say the final outcome is ordained of Yahweh, and they accept it. Even if they don't like it, they say, Yahweh has spoken. Still, other saints are so offended by the lack of righteous choices, they withdraw from participation. There is a biblical basis for this. In Deuteronomy 17, verse 15, it says, Thou shalt not in any wise set him king over thee, whom Yahweh the Elohim shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. So I'm going to give you some tips for sorting this out spiritually. First, for managing your conscience. It is conceivable that Yahweh has a different lesson for each of us in this mess that we have before us right now, a nation that has forgotten its Elohim. I could come up here and say, vote your conscience, but that's kind of a cop-out. It doesn't really tell you anything. You know, anybody could say that. It's not enough to say vote or not vote your conscience. Whatever you decide to do, it's imperative that you assess the consequences of your choice. I think after many years of research, observation, experience, it's very possible you will be one guy over here will be convicted one way and another guy over there is convicted another, because Yahweh wants you to see something. He wants you to experience something. Assess the consequences of your choice. Over time, did your choice remain attractive? Do you regret the choice you made over time? What moral calculation brought you to that choice? Are you voting merely for self-interest or for the better good of the nation? Are you, very importantly, are you voting for a believer in Yahshua as suggested by the Torah? I don't know how I could vote for somebody who's not a believer. I can't see myself voting for an atheist, you know. If the person you're voting for is not a believer in Yahshua, why aren't they? And why would you vote for that? And are there substantive benefits to voting that you have forsaken? For example, there may be something really serious on the ballot. Really serious. And by throwing your hands up and ignoring that because other things in the ballot are unattractive is kind of unwise. I'm going to commend to you something that I've come to feel strongly about. And I believe the scriptures stand with us on this. Get involved locally. Local involvement works under all assumptions. Remember when I started out earlier about these different ways of looking at the possibility of voting? It doesn't matter whether we're a Christian nation, an Israelite nation, if we're in foreign captivity, or if we're suffering foreign occupation. Whatever, it doesn't matter. Look, participation in local events is very wise and very commended by Scripture. I'm going to go back to what I quoted in Jeremiah 29:7. And seek the peace of the city. I emphasize the word city. Seek the peace of the city. That's a local operation. Whither I have caused you to be carried away captives. And pray unto Yahweh for it. For in the peace thereof shall you have peace. So, that tells me become neighborly and get involved with the local affairs. the school board, the town hall meetings, community events, letters to the editor. I kind of like the idea of the people in my community knowing who I am. Almost done. Closing remarks. Brethren who vote do so out of sense of duty, every one of them. And those who abstain also abstain out of a sense of duty. We can only ask that you think prayerfully about your vote and then assess that decision over time, even also the decision not to vote. It's okay to conclude you made a mistake. Boy, I wish I never voted for that guy. That's a very reasonable outcome after enough time goes by. Everybody agrees Yahweh has the final word. So I'm using the decision to vote or not vote as a context in which Yahweh can talk to us and awaken our eyes to spiritual realities. 1 Timothy 2, verse 1 to 3. I exhort, therefore, that first of all supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life with all holiness and honesty. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of Yahweh, our Savior. One last thing. If your candidate wins, you own it. You own that. If you have wanted a certain outcome and you got your outcome, that candidate, he or she, should be the target of a whole heap of regular prayer. I wish someday I could come up here and talk about this mentality of one and done. What, do you think you just pull a lever and leave the voting booth and it's over? These people, when they wind up in power, they need our prayers in a big way. They're subjected to temptations you would not believe. When you get a chance, get a photograph of President Barack Obama when he first took office. It may be a recent photograph, and you can see the graying, the aging. Then go and do that for every president, a photograph before and a photograph after. Every one of these poor guys comes out of there with a gray head, unless they went in that way, you know. You've been very patient with a tedious review. Please think about these things, and every blessing be upon you. Brother Javon.